Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
At this point, all you can do is shake your head and ask, what could be next? First, it was poison pet food, then toxic toothpaste. Today, it's Elmos made in China that are bad for you. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Social Intelligence, The New Science of Human Relationships by Daniel Goleman, author of Emotional Intelligence. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us today. It's Thursday, the 2nd of August. You can't pin it on Elmo, really, or Big Bird or Dora the Explorer. They're just the big names among the million toys worldwide recalled today by Mattel. Some of the company's most valuable franchises arrived in the U.S. coated in lead paint from a Chinese factory. There are some questions about the timing of Mattel's recall, but Marketplace's Janet Babin reports from North Carolina Public Radio the logistics and red tape involved in getting products off the shelves can be daunting.
Mattel says it quarantined most of the million-plus tainted toys before they even hit store shelves. But it's hard to say how long the company knew about the lead-painted toys and how long it took to prepare the recall. Mattel embargoed the press release on the recall until 1 minute past midnight. So why put an embargo on a safety recall anyway? Scott Wilson's with the Consumer Product Safety Commission.
The company must have a telephone bank, their website up, all the resources in place to give a consumer the remedy. And they must pull products out of retail stores before that recall comes out.
Reporter Maurice Posley is with the Chicago Tribune. He says the commission is supposed to speed things up, but ends up hampering the process.
It is an agency that is understaffed, underbudgeted, and pretty much hamstrung by some fairly onerous regulations.
Like the rule that requires the commission to negotiate all recall details and language with the company. That could be what happened with Mattel. The company did not return phone calls. The press embargo didn't hold anyway. The AP says it filed the story early because of a technical error. Other news outlets ended up running with it. Larry Kamers with Fleischman Hillard.
Embargoes are kind of seen as either an artifact of old media, or journalists are going to decide that there is a higher public interest than the schedule of a federal agency.
I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Mattel CEO Bob Eckert did the apologizing, and it's going to be a pretty expensive one. Eckert said the recall will cost the company $30 million. Two firms that make banking software got together today. Fiserv said it's buying CheckFree for $4.2 billion. Chances are Fiserv won't be paying by check. And in fact, this merger may speed up the death of the personal check altogether. Our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barchet reports.
You may not know Fiserv or CheckFree, but your bank does. Fiserv makes the software for bank tellers, ATMs, and backroom check processing. CheckFree's software operates the internet bill pay sites of major banks. CheckFree is also the biggest processor of electronic payments, like the direct deposit of your salary. Jeffrey Yabuki is chief executive of Fiserv. He says this acquisition means more paperless banking.
The capabilities that we're giving our clients are those that allow people to go to the equivalent of a virtual branch online.
Yabuki says paper checks are disappearing at the rate of 5 to 7% a year. Maggie Scarborough is a research manager at IDC Financial Insights. She doesn't think the merger will make the paper check disappear any faster.
I don't know how quickly it will accelerate it. It will certainly make it more available. It always boils down to the consumer and how fast they're willing to adopt.
Edmund Merzwinski is a consumer banking advocate at the Public Interest Research Group. He thinks that paperless banking is more about bank profits than making life easier for the consumer.
The banks make more money, they process less paper, they get their money more quickly.
Merzwinski says if customers have disputes, they have more legal rights if they have some kind of paper trail. He wants Congress to put new consumer protections in place as more banking goes online. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
We mentioned earlier this week the jam Adobe had found itself in. The document company had made a deal with Fenix Kinko's that would have let users send their projects straight to the printing shop with the click of a mouse. It was none too popular with other printers who let their feelings be known. Score one for the little guys on this one. Adobe's going to get rid of that link to FedEx Kinko's in its next update. Caffeinated profits from Starbucks helped give investors a jolt. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. While recovery crews continue their work at the site of the bridge collapse in Minneapolis, the blame game has already started. White House Press Secretary Tony Snow said today the state would have been responsible for fixing whatever might have been wrong with the bridge. Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty responded there was no indication that the bridge was in such bad shape. Wherever the finger-pointing does end, news of problems with this country's infrastructure is nothing new. Ron Dearden runs the Mineta Transportation Institute at San Jose State University. Mr. Dearden, welcome to the program.
Kai, nice to be with you.
Governor Pawlenty up in Minnesota said today he was going to order immediate inspections of all the bridges in that state. I imagine governors in other states are thinking along those same lines. What are they going to find when they start looking around?
That our bridges and other infrastructure are in terrible condition. We built those infrastructure elements 40, 50, 60 years ago as part of the state highway system and have not had the money to maintain that infrastructure while we're also expanding to meet future need. And so we're going to be told again that bridges are in terrible condition. Probably 25-30% of them are on the verge of unsafe in the nation. But that's not new news.
But Congress, every 5 years, passes a transportation bill that runs $200-300 billion. How much of that, if any, goes to infrastructure upkeep and repair?
Well, the majority of it does. But remember, when the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee of Congress came forward with their proposal, it was for $375 billion. And a veto threat from the administration made them compromise that down to $294 billion, much less than was the minimum projected to be required by the U.S. Department of Transportation.
Is there an amount of money in your mind that we can spend that would fix things over the next 10, 15 years?
The need is horrendous. We're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars. It cannot be met with current revenue sources. They have to expand the transportation system because the need is expanding. At the same time, they don't have enough money to maintain the systems. So they have to respond then to the political pressure of legislators who typically would rather expand than maintain because there's a lot more excitement in building a new bridge than maintaining an old one. We have to be talking about new revenue sources such as gas tax increases, such as carbon taxes, such as congestion pricing that are being used in other places in the world. But we have avoided those in the United States because we're so sensitive to gas tax increases.
It's worth mentioning that it's not just bridges, as tragic as yesterday's incident was. It's water supplies and tunnels. It's the steam pipe that exploded in New York City a couple of weeks ago.
It's the levees that we recognized as being deficient in New Orleans. All of our infrastructure throughout the United States has been built quite some time ago. And it has not been maintained as it should have been because we don't have the monies, and we just can't do it unless additional funding is invested in our infrastructure maintenance and expansion.
You probably were not surprised by what happened yesterday, as I would wager most transportation professionals weren't. Is your sense that probably most of the rest of us were?
Well, yes. I'm imagining that the people were surprised because we expect to be protected. When we use infrastructure, we expect it to be safe. And the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials has been coming out with their deficient bridge reports for years. And you look at the report, you say, gee, our bridges are falling down, and then you file it. Well, it can't be filed unless we want more situations like Minnesota to face us day in and day out.
Rod Dearden is the executive director of the Mineta Transportation Institute at San Jose State University. Mr. Dearden, thanks so much for your time.
Nice to be with you, Kai.
We don't think about infrastructure until something is wrong, and maybe that's the point. So, what's wrong where you live, and what's your town doing about it? Go to marketplace.org and help us tell the story. There was big news for residents of downtown Los Angeles a couple of weeks ago. A brand new Ralph's grocery store opened up. That's not ordinarily something that would merit a mention, but it's the first real grocery store anywhere in downtown. Not too far away, though. Away from the fancy lofts and high-rise apartment buildings, it's a different story. Most supermarkets stay away from low-income parts of big cities. But the British grocery giant Tesco sees opportunity where others see risks. It plans to roll out 100 stores in the western U.S. during the next year, many of them in the kinds of places other supermarkets won't go. Jordan Davis reports.
Rosa Herone lives just south of downtown Los Angeles, in full view of its sparkling high-rises. Her neighborhood grocery store is less than sparkling. Bottles of vodka, gin, brandy are stacked to the ceiling behind the register.
You can see it's a very small market.
The market's single aisle is too narrow for us to walk side by side. We squeezed past a display of lettuce greens turning sickly shades of brown. The refrigerators are stocked with sugary yogurt, lard, packets of American cheese slices, and gallons of milk just about to expire for $4.
You're saying, so these are like high prices.
Oh, yeah, very high. Yeah, very high.
You get the picture. Rosa Herone's neighborhood is a food desert, a supermarketless Sahara where low-income residents are stuck getting something to eat at a liquor store or a fast food joint. British supermarket chain Tesco sees opportunity in neighborhoods like these. Tesco's announced plans for a dozen of its fresh and easy markets across the L.A. area, including one in Compton. It's in negotiations for 7 more locations in underserved Los Angeles neighborhoods. Stores will be on the small side, but they'll offer fresh produce, meats, and prepared meals. Simon Ewens is Fresh and Easy's marketing director. He says customers want the same thing, no matter how much they earn.
Almost irrespective of the type of household we went into, people were telling us what they wanted was fresh, wholesome food, but they wanted it to be affordable, and they wanted it to be available in their neighborhood.
That might go double for South Los Angeles grocery shoppers. Supermarkets pledged to build new stores there after the 1992 riots. But a decade and a half later, residents often have to go miles out of their way to get quality groceries. Ewan says Fresh and Easy wouldn't be looking at the inner city if it couldn't make money.
Clearly, we're not a charity. The reason that we're going there is because we believe that we can be successful there.
Tesco may find it tough to make money in these areas. Amanda Schaefer is a researcher at the Urban and Environmental Policy Institute at Occidental College. She says supermarkets who've tried this in the past found their profit margins squeezed. Low-income customers tend to make smaller, more frequent trips to the store.
So that means that the operating costs on a per-customer basis end up being higher in a low-income neighborhood.
Driving through her neighborhood, Rosa Herone says life without a half-decent supermarket has hidden costs for the people who live in the community. She's a health educator, and she sees the results of poor diet in her work every day.
This community is an emergency for obesity and diabetes for children because they don't eat right.
Tesco says as many as a dozen Fresh and Easy stores could spring up across the city by the end of the year. But so far, the company has a firm commitment to just one inner-city location. Residents hope the plans for these oases in the food desert of South L.A. don't turn out to be a mirage. In Los Angeles, I'm Jordan Davis for Marketplace.
Some say it's a good idea. Others say,
don't do it. if your objective is to break even or make a profit, there's almost no chance of that happening.
Giant pandas as a loss leader. But first, let's do the numbers. Markets managed to stay positive today. The Dow Industrials gained 100 points, 0.75%, and at 13,463. The NASDAQ rose 22 points, 0.9%, to finish at 2575. The S&P 500 added 6 points, 0.4%, wrapped up at 1472. Viacom gained 1%. Today, CVS Caremark rose 3.5%. Both companies posted results that exceeded expectations. Eastman Kodak snapped up almost 5.5%. The company swung to a second quarter profit as it continues to cut costs and concentrate on digital photography and commercial printing. We mentioned Fiserv is buying CheckFree. That electronic payment company picked up 23% today. Nokia dialed up 8.75% on soaring profits. Hewlett-Packard fattened up 3.25% after UBS raised its price forecast on the computer and printer maker. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.76%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on unemployment for July. President Bush holds meetings and lunches with the counterterrorism and homeland security teams at FBI headquarters. And you'll be seeing double in Twinsburg, Ohio, at the world's largest gathering of twins. Activities during the annual Twins Days Festival include the Double Take Parade, of course. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The days when you sidled up to a scalper at a concert or a ball game to score a last-minute ticket are largely gone. Nowadays, what's called the secondary market in event tickets has gone high-tech. You can try eBay or Craigslist. A company named StubHub, too. It's an online ticket reseller. That's the official name for the secondary market. And it's owned by eBay. It also has a brand-new deal with Major League Baseball, as Marketplace's Steve Henn explains.
If there's one ticket most baseball fans wouldn't mind buying tonight, it's got to be to the Dodgers-Giants game. With Barry Bonds on the brink of breaking the all-time home run record, it's a chance to witness history. But
I believe that game sold out.
Greg Bettinelli is director of business development for the online ticket reseller StubHub.
Imagine in 2008, if that game was sold out, you could then be directed directly on that club site to StubHub, where you could find tickets for tonight's game.
Bettinelli just inked a deal with Major League Baseball, giving StubHub the exclusive rights to resell tickets in concert with the league. There'll even be a direct link to StubHub from MLB sites. But there's one catch.
My guess is this will only make it harder for average fans to get reasonably priced good seats.
Russ Haven from the New York Public Interest Research Group is a critic of the big fees charged by StubHub, which pockets 25% of the resale price. He thinks the new deal will only make scalpers more aggressive. But Bob Bowman, the CEO of MajorLeagueBaseball.com, says giving fans an easy way to resell unwanted tickets is essential.
This is what the fans want to do, particularly in baseball. You buy 81-game package, you're not going to go to 81 games.
But even after the deal goes into effect, StubHub won't be the only place to scalp tickets online. The site will still have to compete with Craigslist, eBay, and everything else. Just FYI, for tonight's game at Dodger Stadium, tickets in the outfield are selling for about $70 a pop on Craigslist. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Beijing's Olympic countdown clock in Tiananmen Square is about to click over to 365 days left. The opening ceremony is scheduled for a year from next Wednesday. China will be the capital of the sporting world for the 2.5 weeks the games are on. But Diana Nyad's here to tell us the business of sports in China is much bigger than that. Hey, Diana.
Kai, how are you?
I'm all right. So even given all the problems that we talked about earlier in the show with Chinese imports and poisoned pet food and toys now, American businesses still do want to get into China, and they're doing it increasingly now through sports.
Oh, they do in a big way. I mean, if you look at the sort of the macro picture, you know, the economic and political reform started in China in the 80s. That meant by the 90s. Companies were cooking. I mean, you know, the average Chinese citizen now has much more disposable income than he or she ever had before. And a big thing they're doing with that income, I mean, you can go out into the rural provinces, and I know you've been there. You'll see, you know, the old people doing Tai Chi in the front yard, and it's wonderful. But you go into the urban centers, and the young people are joining health clubs. A health club opens every day in mainland China, one a day. And so there are 50,000 of them right now, and they're just proliferating. And they have personal trainers. And so So sporting goods businesses, and there are five sort of top companies there, they're gaining. It's something close to 20% a year. It's a great investment.
Who's doing it? Obviously, Nike's probably a big one. Who else?
Nike's been there for 24 years. The most recent statistics I have since 2005, they're gaining at about 19% a year, much bigger than they're gaining here. Spalding is now the official ball and all kinds of gear sponsor for the Chinese national basketball team. And so, you know, Spalding has latched on to the Chinese philosophy of Let's get out there and have all these young people who want to get into sports in a rabid way, let's get them geared up.
Major League Baseball is trying to have exhibition games over there. I mean, it's one thing to go do it in Japan. It's pretty remarkable, though, that I think it's the Yankees are trying to go and have an exhibition game.
Well, you know, the first two Chinese baseball players to ever play in the major leagues are playing for the Yankees. There's a pitcher and a catcher. And the first Chinese company ever to invest in the MLB is with the Yankees. It's a dairy company called Yili, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. So yeah, the Yankees are now, you know, in bed with a Chinese company and very interested, as is Major League Baseball, interested in going all over the world. That's the whole World Baseball Classic is about.
Sure.
So this past time around, we saw the countries that have been playing for 100 years, Venezuela and Cuba and Japan. But China is going to come on very quickly, as they are in all sports.
Let me get this back to the Olympics for a second. It is now a year until the games start. Obviously, Beijing has known for 6 or 7 years that it's going to have the games. Has it used that deadline, if you will, as a way to increase its domestic sports development programs with its athletes?
You know, it has. Number one, on the sort of human side, not the economic side for a minute. Beijing is being compared a lot to Moscow, and they remind me of the old Soviet machine in that they will now identify young athletes at 4 and 5 and 6 years old, get them into academies, get them into the finest coaching that this planet has to offer. There's a young woman, Li Na, who's a national treasure at this point, was a badminton player, converted to tennis, unheard of in our country, and has now reached the quarterfinals of Wimbledon, which was last year in 06, and she's been virtually carried around on people's shoulders. So there is a movement toward let's get our athletes at the top rung of the world in every sport imaginable by Beijing 2008.
I read on the wires the other day that the Minister of Sports said, oh, no, we're not trying to beat the United States in a medal count in the Beijing Games. You buying that?
No. There's going to be, you know, just like we used to do more of, there's going to be, you know, we'll all know how to count in Chinese, let's say, by the end of the Games.
All right, the Business of Sports with Diana Nia. Thanks, Diana.
Thank you so much, Kai.
When you think about products that are made in China, these days it's usually words like toxic and dangerous that spring to mind, not rare and cute. But that would be forgetting about one of China's most popular exports, the giant panda. Four zoos in the United States have them on loan. They're always crowd favorites, especially when they have babies. Bai Yun at the San Diego Zoo is expecting her fourth cub sometime this month. But cute or not, they rack up a hefty bill. From Washington, home to 3 of the 12 pandas in the United States, Jeremy Hobson reports now on Pandanomics.
After 9/11, visitor traffic at the National Zoo plummeted. Years went by, and nothing seemed to draw people back until 2005, when the baby panda was born. Now you can listen to Taishan's baby squeals by pressing a button in the zoo's panda house. After the birth, the zoo's attendance skyrocketed, almost to where it was pre-9/11. And the zoo says fully 80% of the visitors were coming to see the pandas.
All right, where's our baby? Here he comes.
That's National Zoo Deputy Director Mary Tanner. Baby Tyshawn is taking a break from playtime in his yard and coming inside for some fresh bamboo.
It's so funny to watch him come in, and he's such a big boy now, but he was so cute when he was little.
He's still pretty cute and pretty spoiled, too. The National Zoo, with the help of private and corporate money, has put the pandas in its brand new Asia Trail, which is like the Ritz of zoo exhibits. There are chilled boulders, fog machines to make visitors feel like they're in China, and air-conditioned caves for the pandas.
They obviously like nice, cool spots. You'll see Tian in his cave, sitting in air-conditioned comfort now.
And they obviously like all their colors to match.
They like all their colors to match.
The cost of this fancy new color-coordinated exhibit, the loans, the caretakers, and all the rest, just $20 million. And here's the kicker. Zoos aren't allowed to make much profit on the bears. Jeanette Hemley with the World Wildlife Fund says that's because of what happened in the late 1980s, which she calls the rent-a-panda period.
The Chinese knew they had a cash cow on their hands. They were sending pandas out all over the world because zoos were willing to pay exorbitant fees because people love pandas.
The Toledo Zoo used panda profits to build a parking lot, which was the bamboo stick that broke the panda's back, if you will. The World Wildlife Fund and others sued, and now most of the profits, if there are any, have to go to panda conservation. Emily says the same goes for the millions zoos pay China to rent the pandas.
A lot of money is trading hands, but I think we're on a much better footing than we were 10 or 15 years ago in that we do know that money is going back into the conservation of pandas in the wild in China, and for us that's the bottom line.
But what about the bottom line for zoos? Why put up with all the costs if you're not going to make much money? I asked Dave Town, former president of the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, what he would tell a zookeeper trying to get a panda.
Don't do it. If your objective is to break even or make a profit, there's almost no chance of that happening.
Even with a baby panda, he says. U.S. zoos say they see a big spike in attendance after a birth, but Town says it doesn't last.
The cuteness wears off a little bit very quickly.
Still, two of the U.S. zoos lucky enough to have had panda births charge admission, and they enjoyed a temporary spike in ticket sales. The National Zoo is free, and its attendance hasn't fallen off since Tyshawn was born.
Here he goes.
And all those visitors still bring their wallets and load up with plenty of panda products. If you're looking for the National Zoo's gift shop, by the way, it's right across from the panda exhibit. You can't miss it. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, we've got the $5 bill here in 10s, 20s, all the way up to a $100 bill in regular circulation. In Zimbabwe, they've got the $200,000 bill, worth about 13 bucks American. All it'll buy you is a couple of pounds of sugar. The government of President Robert Mugabe released the bill yesterday, the latest step in coping with Zimbabwe's runaway inflation. Last year, Mugabe tried something a little bit different. He lopped a couple of zeros off the largest denomination banknotes in circulation. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 100 points, 0.75%. The NASDAQ gained 22 points, 0.9%. The S&P 500 jumped 6 points, 0.4% there. Our editors include John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, and Lisa Tucker. Next time, men, did you ever struggle finding dates? Well, fear no more. There's somebody who's paid to pitch in.
Her objective is to help you and give you feedback and introduce you to women.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen.
That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.